cases 22-5104 and 22-5125, SC versus Metropolitan Government of Nashville and Davidson County, Tennessee. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes for the defendant, 10 minutes for the plaintiff, and 5 minutes for the amicus. Counsel, you may proceed for the appellant when ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Melissa Roberge on behalf of MNPS. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
Title IX is a contract. In return for federal funds, MNPS agreed not to discriminate on the basis of sex. Because Title IX is a contract, the Supreme Court has defined both the scope of damages and the conduct for which MNPS can be liable narrowly. MNPS asks that this court adhere to that precedent and make four rulings. Vacate the damages under the Supreme Court's decision in Cummings, affirm summary judgment on the Title IX before claim, consistent with Gebser and Davis. 3, reverse on the Title IX after claim, because the judgment is based on a theory that was not in the pretrial order. 4, and not take any action on Section 1983. Summary judgment was denied, the case was tried, MNPS prevailed, and that judgment has not been appealed. In defining the parameters of spending clause litigation, the Supreme Court held that emotional damages are not part of the contract and are not recoverable.
Did you raise that issue below?
We did not, Your Honor. Prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Cummings in April of 2022, this court had approved of emotional damages in spending clause cases.
Were those published or unpublished opinions?
I believe it was a variety of opinions. One was Moreno and Verlesi v. Wayne, both of which are cited in our brief, and then the published decision of Johnson v. City of Saline, which affirmed compensatory damages under Section 504. And the Cummings decision—
You just said compensatory. Did it explicitly deal with emotional?
It did.
What case is that again?
That is Johnson v. City of Saline.
And what's the site?
151 F3D 564.
Thank you.
And in Cummings, the Supreme Court was looking at the Rehab Act and Section 5, I'm sorry, was looking at Rehab Act and the Affordable Care Act. But it didn't focus on the statutory scheme of either of those. It focused on the power of Congress to enact those statutes. And that is the same power that Congress used to enact Title IX. Now, Cummings incorporates the backdrop of general damages, and there's three categories of damages. There are special damages, and those are capable of being determined with mathematical precision. We can think of those as our out-of-pocket expenses. There's general damages, which are your emotional damages, your pain and suffering damages. Those aren't subject to a pecuniary mathematical precision-like formula. And then there are punitive damages. Barnes and Cummings tell us that two categories of damages are not available, the general damages and the punitive damages. That only leaves this pecuniary out-of-pocket expenses. And at the trial in this case, the plaintiff in the pretrial order asked for those types of damages, but they weren't proven. The record doesn't contain any evidence of any out-of-pocket expenses. No tutoring expenses, no amount of how much it costs to educate a student. The only proof presented was on emotional damages.
So if you would refresh for me, I think my understanding was that the district judge awarded $75,000 for damages, but that it included everything and was not apportioned as to what of the various categories of damages there were. Am I correct on that?
You are correct that the district court listed a list of the types of damages, but the district court did not make any findings on out-of-pocket expenses. And the district court couldn't have made that finding because there was no proof in the record about those damages.
So wouldn't the appropriate thing, given that Cummings came down subsequent to the DJ's decision, right?
Correct.
Wouldn't the appropriate thing be for us to remand if we agreed with your position that Cummings controls?
Your Honor, the appropriate thing for this court to do is to vacate the damages award because these damages were available pre-Cummings. This isn't a, Cummings didn't create a new category of damages. It just narrowed what damages you can recover for. The plaintiff had the opportunity to put proof in the record if there were any out-of-pocket expenses.
But the plaintiff didn't know that Cummings was going to come down. And you're saying that the law, even in a published case, in this City of Saline case, was that she could receive damages, including for emotional distress. So wouldn't we be expecting her to do something that she didn't need to do at that point in time, given that her claim was that she had emotional distress damages as among the other damages?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it would be expecting the plaintiff to do something she wouldn't otherwise be expected to do. These, again, these damages had been a part of the type of damages pre-Cummings, pre-Barnes. And importantly, the plaintiff also had a Section 1983 claim. So the emotional damages would still be relevant to that claim. So this isn't a situation where the plaintiff only had one claim and the law changed completely in the middle. There were two claims. And for both of those claims, the categories of damages that were available, the category of damages, if you'd look at both claims, was both general and special. Now, under Title IX, she can only recover those special damages. Because there was no proof in the record, the damages award should be vacated. And the Supreme Court decided in Harper v. Virginia Department of Taxation, when the Supreme Court applies a rule of federal law to the parties before it, that rule is the controlling interpretation of federal law and must be given full effect. We would ask that this court vacate the damages award. Again, to be consistent with Supreme Court precedent, summary judgment on the Title IX claim, on the Title IX before claim, should be affirmed. MMPS is aware that this court is not writing on a blank slate, and that Judge Moore and Judge Gibbons were part of the panel that made the decision in Doe.
I thought it odd that your brief, your opening brief, pretty much ignored Doe, even though I think at the time it was filed, our court had both denied rehearing en banc, and the Supreme Court had denied cert. You didn't want to acknowledge it existed very much, did you?
Your Honor, our opening brief was advancing our arguments on the issues that we believed that where the trial court erred. We don't believe that the trial court erred in granting MMPS summary judgment on the before claim. Because what Doe did is recognize that a before claim or a claim based on the harassment of others is a viable claim in the circuit. But what we're asking this court to clarify is that the standard announced in Doe is not constructive notice. And we know that it's not constructive notice because of Gebster. Element two of the Doe test is that the deliberate indifference create a heightened risk of sexual harassment that was known or obvious. Gebster answers that question for us. It explicitly rejected a known or should have known standard. The facts of Gebster make clear that severe conduct aimed at others, in the words of Justice O'Connor, is plainly insufficient.
Well, isn't there evidence that the school district knew of these other incidents the video incidents and sexual harassment? Isn't there evidence that they knew of that from other students?
There is evidence that that had occurred in the school system before, but what's also in evidence is that MMPS took disciplinary action on each of those cases.
So that indicates they knew.
It doesn't indicate that they knew that there was a systemic problem.
Well, I don't understand why you're saying it's constructive notice. If they took disciplinary action, it seems like they actually knew. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken disciplinary action.
So they didn't have actual notice of a particular risk to this plaintiff. So what Gebser had...
That kind of goes against the reasoning of Doe, doesn't it? Because Doe doesn't require that you have harassment of the particular plaintiff. It's just knowledge of the type of harassment in the system. At least that's the way I'm reading Doe.
So Doe stands for the proposition that you can rely on the harassment of others, but there still must be some nexus to the harassment of the plaintiff. in cases that the Doe Court cited with approval, both Simpson out of the 10th Circuit and Williams out of the 11th Circuit, I apologize. In Simpson, it was all contained within the football program. So the initial sexual assault happened at a football recruiting party. The subsequent harassment happened at a football recruiting party.
Right, but in Doe itself, the facts are very similar to what we have here. So why isn't that precedent that we have to apply here? I mean, it's the same school district, right? I mean,
it is, and candidly, it's the same order. And so what we are asking is that this court clarify Doe. We're not asking this court to take any action inconsistent with Doe. The argument in Doe was that a before claim wasn't viable under Kolarich because it couldn't satisfy the same victim requirement. This court drew a distinction between the claims in Kolarich, which are after claims, and the claims here, which are before claims. We're asking this court to offer further clarity to both district courts and school districts that there still must be some nexus to the harassment for there to be liable.
If we overturned in Doe what the district court had done on the before claims, don't we have to overturn what the district court did on the before claims here?
No, Your Honor, because court reversed and remanded. It didn't deny summary judgment to MMPS, and this court can affirm for any reason found in the record. And so this court can answer the question that we're asking of it, which is constructive notice enough? And we know that it's constructive notice because the district court has described it that way several times throughout this litigation. In the very first summary judgment order, the district court describes the risk as known and obvious, which is identical to how Gebser described knew or should have known. Because the only notice was constructive, the before claim grant of summary judgment should be affirmed. I'm out of time, Your Honor, if I may finish.
Well, if you want to use your rebuttal time, feel free.
Thank you.
Good morning, judges. Mary Parker of the Nashville Bar, representing the Appellee SC. This case, I will start with the forfeit issue with regard to damages. There is not a single case that was cited by Metro in its brief that analyzed or considered whether emotional damages were recoverable. The Clemens case, it was not a reported case. It did not address the issue directly. The Varlisi came, same thing, not published, not controlling, and the court wasn't asked if emotional damages were reasonable. Then they cite our case, this case underlying, as though the district court is authority that Your Honor should follow, when we're asking that it be dealt with by the court and followed the Doe opinion and Sally and Jane be followed. Then they cite the Doe v. University of Kentucky. Again, it's not controlling. No party asked the court to decide emotional injuries. We don't deny that emotional injuries have been considered by the court. They've been considered in the contest of remittitor. They've been considered in various contests. But if the defense never raises the issue of whether they're legitimate or not, it's not for the Court of Appeals to decide whether those damages should or should not have been awarded. It's for that to be raised at the district level to give the district court an opportunity to make a decision on that.
What about this Jonathan case that she cited?
You know what? That is not in her brief, and I am not familiar with that case.
I didn't see it in the briefs anywhere.
No, and I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with that case. I felt like I did a thorough job of researching and updating, and I did not find that one. But I'm looking at it's a third case, I believe she said, so that has to be an older case. And I apologize for not being familiar with it. But I will say there was a similar case, Ashfall, in the 9th Circuit that we cited, or perhaps we didn't because it would have been in our reply brief, I'm sorry. But Ashfall, and it talks about the forfeiture issue in the context of Title IX. And it talks about it needed to be brought to the court's attention. It's interesting in the brief of the defendant that in the very first instance, when they start arguing that the damages should be not considered, and they talk about existing law that was compelling and allowed them to treat Cummings as new law, they cite the case of the Gorman case, that Barnes v. Gorman, which is a 2002 U.S. Supreme Court case. They want this court to rely upon that for the fact that contract damages are all you can receive. But then why didn't they bring it up? If they want to argue Gorman now, then Barnes v. Gorman, I guess I should say Barnes, then why didn't they bring it up for the trial court to consider that? They had they were on notice that it could be a viable claim, that damages could be limited to contract damages, and perhaps emotional damages would not be available. They chose not to. So they have forfeited that issue because the district court was not given the opportunity to consider it.
And emotional distress damages are available under 1983?
Yes. Yes. And in terms of what the court awarded $75,000 in damages for she described it as loss of educational opportunity and some for monetary damages for pain and suffering. She never even mentioned the word emotional, but based upon the evidence that was produced at trial, I would suggest that pain and suffering was most likely for emotional damages. Now, defendant did not only not raise it before the court, they hired a forensic psychiatrist to discuss the emotional damages that the plaintiff had suffered, and that was part of their proof in their case in chief. So to suggest now that it just doesn't matter that they didn't raise it before the district court and they put on their own emotional damages information is just ingenuous. There is no question that Sally and Jane Doe should be applied to this case. Not only is it similar issues, it is the exact identical summary judgment motion and order that this court vacated and remanded. There is nothing about SC's case that differs from Sally and Jane in terms of the law that was applied and the applicability of that particular case to this case. And in terms of the court doesn't really...
So to follow Doe, you're saying that we should vacate and remand the district judge's ruling on the before claims?
On the before claim, yes. On her summary judgment ruling, on her before claims with regard to both Title IX and 1983. The defense argues in its brief that there is nothing in the record that supports the notion that summary judgment was granted to Metro on any claim that SC brought under 1983. That's just factually wrong.
Are you arguing for any kind of a remand based on Doe for the after claims?
Are we arguing for remand?
Right. Are you?
No, we have not.
The district court accurately evaluated the after claims in light of, I mean, obviously Doe had not come down, but
right.
But there's not any inconsistency in the district court's analysis of the after claims with Doe?
I don't think there is. If anything, there is. She applied Coleridge to the after claim and made a decision with regard to Coleridge on 1983. But the before claim is the essence of 1983 anyways. So we would like the opinion of the court to be affirmed, the damages to be affirmed. If anything, perhaps a remand on clarity of what she meant by the $75,000 and how it was applied to educational loss and or whatever. But we think they forfeited that issue and even the damages should be confirmed by this court. And that part of her ruling should stand. As far as, yes, ma'am.
This is beside the point, so I'm straying a little bit. Are there other claims pending before Judge Trauger at this point involving similar facts in the Metro school system?
Sally and Jane Doe have not gone to trial yet. Then there are two other cases pending in Judge Crenshaw's court in that district. And we have others pending in different counties.
Against the Metro?
No, the two in Judge Crenshaw's court are from Metro. And then there's Sally and Jane Doe still in Judge Trauger's court. And then Mary Doe, which was one of the original four, was settled.
And did I hear you correctly to say you're suing other counties for this
Yes.
similar type of situation?
Yes.
So this is not a problem unique to Nashville?
I would say it's a problem unique to Middle, or it's a problem in Middle Tennessee. I don't know how widespread it is.
I mean, are there suits in other parts of the country involving students having sex, videotaping, and
right.
I mean, does that happen around the country?
Well, there are a number. I mean, the Ashwell case that I cited, that was in the Ninth Circuit. There is a Fairfax opinion case that came out of the Fourth Circuit. There are, and I think counsel for just
had the point, but I'm interested in the answer to Judge Bush's question too. I just find it incredible that this is happening in schools. I mean, I cannot completely apart from my experience and that, you know, I had children who went to public school, and
I
don't think anything like this, if it was going on, I was certainly an ignorant mother.
I don't think so. I think cell phones have really changed the whole parameter of the system and social media, and it's made it very...
Why are children... I'm sorry, I'm about to digress.
I know, and I want to join you.
So if I could clarify, just to be sure that I understand your position, do you contend that the district judge applied Coleridge to the after claims and that we should vacate and remand for reconsideration of after claims in light of Doe or not?
We're not asking for that.
Not asking for that.
Yes, we're not.
So you're happy with the way the after claims were decided?
Well, I can't say I'm happy with only $75,000.
But you're not appealing.
She was right.
Okay.
Okay, we don't think there is a basis for overturning that.
But on the other hand, you are appealing vis-a-vis the 1983 claims.
The 1983 and the Title IX before claims.
And the 1983 claims all pertain to before claims also.
Yes. I have a lot of factual errors in the defendant's brief that I can address if you want me to do that, or if you have any further questions of more substance.
I have a question about what you contend the school district should have done. I think your position is they did nothing.
Exactly.
Is that your position?
Exactly.
I guess I'm wondering, in light of this pervasive problem, it seems like, around the country, of kids using cell phones for nefarious reasons. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to take away the cell phones of all the students?
I would if I were in charge, but I'm not.
They could, consistent with the First Amendment, take away the cell phones of the students at the school?
I know the private schools do it. I don't know why you can't.
The public schools in Memphis, at least at the times my children were there, you could not have a cell phone.
Exactly.
On school premises, period. And it was punishable by serious disciplinary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, the disciplinary code at the school is absurdly lax. This executive principal, when she took control of the videotape, she had absolute ability to stop the spread of the videotape with regard to the students. She really exercised control. What she demonstrated is, if she took seriously the threats, she could have exercised control again. But she just ignored them.
Your red light is on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jason Lee for the United States as amicus. This court should affirm the district court's ruling and judgment in SC's favor with regard to the threats she received, but on a slightly different basis than what the district court used. This court should vacate the prior summary judgment ruling, which vacated SC's other theories of relief in the same way this court did in the related Doe proceedings. And depending on how it deals with the forfeiture issue, remand to reconsider the damages award in light of Cummings in the first instance by the district court would be an appropriate course of action. With regard to the Title IX claim that the district court entered judgment on, there are four bases on which Metro challenges that ruling. None of those bases have any merit. First, Metro alleges that retaliatory peer harassment is not actionable under this court's precedents. That's an elevation of form over substance, and it's foreclosed by Supreme Court precedent. In the Jackson case, the Supreme Court specifically said that retaliation is a form of intentional sex discrimination that violates Title IX. Jackson explained that retaliation is integral to making sure that Title IX's enforcement structure can operate. They called it vital. And so I think under Jackson, as well as under other appellate court precedent, including Doe out of the 10th Circuit, the Feminist Majority Foundation out of the 4th Circuit, retaliatory peer harassment is actionable. Another basis.
A question here. It seems like she's not arguing for after claims here. She's just arguing for before claims. And so I guess the question is, or one of the questions I have is, did the school district, how did they respond to the situation once they knew that that this video had occurred? I mean, they did suspend students. They referred them to the police. Under Davis, don't we have to defer to what decision the school district makes in terms of remediation? Why shouldn't we just defer here? And given they did do some things, it wasn't completely deliberately indifferent.
So let me distinguish between the before claims and the after claims. With regard to the before claims, that argument is best considered by the district court in the first instance on remand. In Doe, this court instructed that before claims should be analyzed under the Ninth Circuit's case called Karasek. It's appropriate for the district court to apply Karasek in the first instance. With regard to deliberate indifference for the after claims, which you had asked counsel about, here I think there's an effective concession by Metro that school officials did nothing in response to the threats to remedy the deprivation of educational opportunity. Now, of course, school officials have deference with regard to the array of choices that they have before them to respond to this type of harassment, but here what you had was a complete abdication of any response. And under this court's...
Well, suspending students for 3 days was not an abdication of response, was it?
That was not action taken with regard to the threats. With the threats that were specifically...
That was not action. What?
The response that the school took was in for the distribution of the video.
Threats are after claims.
So there's at least three forms of sex-based harassment that she was subject to that could potentially provide basis for liability: the video and distribution of the video, the actual sexual assault, and the threats that were intended to keep Essie out of school, that were intended to prevent her.
Those are the after claims.
That's one type of after claim.
Are there any threats that are before claims, though?
No.
Okay. So it sounds like the appeal right now, we're talking about just before claims.
The before claim was dismissed at summary judgment, so that claim is best considered by the district court in the first instance.
What about the Doe case would require us to remand on the before claims?
Doe held that the district court, in this very same order, as counsel mentioned, misapplied Coleridge, and for that reason remanded the before claims for the district court to consider. That's where those claims stand, and the same approach is warranted here.
Did the district court rule on the district court did rule on the sufficiency of the remediation to the before claims, didn't it?
Yes.
And said it was insufficient, right?
Yes, but this court also announced that Karasek standard would apply. That would be that's a change in law for this circuit. So at least in terms of the application of Karasek to the facts in this case, that's something that the district court can appropriately do.
Okay.
And it certainly hasn't been briefed by the parties. If I could just mention the substantial control argument, Metro contends that there's not substantial control under Davis here. There's substantial control for at least two reasons. First, there's a clear nexus to the school environment. These threats were intended to keep SC out of school and not participating in an investigation by the school into a sexual assault that took place at school and a video that was distributed by students while they were on campus. There's a clear nexus to the school environment, and there's also clear prior practice. We know what school officials did in response to comparable forms of digital harassment, which was investigate and impose discipline. There's no reason school officials couldn't have done the same here. And with this court's indulgence, if I might mention one thing with regard to the damages award. Again, depending on how this court handles the forfeiture issue, remand would be an appropriate course for consideration of the Cummings issue, which has not been briefed by the parties before this court. And it seems likely, because remand is necessary under Doe, that the district court is going to have to reconsider damages with regard to the entirety of this case regardless. So for those reasons, this court should affirm in part, vacate in part, and potentially remand. Thank you.
To be clear, there is no concession from MNPS that it did nothing. I want to talk about the afterclaims. Davis requires that there be severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive harassment for afterclaims, that the school have actual notice, then that the school respond with deliberate indifference, and then that there be post-notice harassment. What we're talking about for the severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive conduct is the sex act, the recording of it, and the dissemination of it. And Judge Gibbons, I share your outrage that this is happening at schools across the country, but a search of the case law shows that it is. It's not an MNPS problem. It's not a Middle Tennessee problem.
Well, but
it's
there were
problem.
Hundreds of cases apparently in MNPS.
I believe there were like 1,200 or something that had been reported in some fairly immediate time frame prior to the actions that gave rise to these lawsuits in the Middle District.
Those were 1,200 instances of school misconduct labeled as sexual harassment. Those were not 1,200 instances of students using their cell phones to record sex acts and then share.
Well,
I just want to clear that up.
I didn't say they were.
Okay.
But there was a lot of conduct that there was different conduct described in Doe, you know, lots of different things.
Correct.
That would fall within that.
Correct.
You say that the school district reacted to the threats. These were threats after the circulation of the video, threats against SC for complaining about the video. What exactly are you saying the record shows MNPS did?
These were threats against SC. The record shows, to answer your question, the record shows that MNPS referred these violent threats against a non-student to the police. And again, on that timeline that I diagrammed out.
Against a non-student, you're talking about threats that were not against SC, or are you
correct.
Saying because SC was removed from school because she was being harassed so much?
No, I'm saying they were threats against her family and against her mom in particular. And SC testified that the main person who was threatening her was SD, who was disciplined for 3 days for her role in this initial harassment. So in that diagram that I kind of metaphorically drew out, the threats are not over here. The threats were not what MNPS had actual notice of. The United States describes this as a misstep by the district court, but it wasn't a misstep. The district court found exactly what was in the plaintiff's pretrial order, that MNPS had actual notice of the recording and the dissemination of the video. And then it described its response as a good faith, earnest effort. The threats were the subsequent actionable harassment. That theory of relief was not included at all in plaintiff's pretrial order. This isn't an 11th hour switch. The clock struck midnight when the pretrial order was filed, and the trial was on the afterclaim, with the threats not being the actionable harassment, but being the post-notice harassment. So we would ask that you reverse on the afterclaim. I believe it was Judge Sutton in Bowes v. Bay expressed skepticism that this type of retaliatory peer-on-peer harassment claim existed. And this court shouldn't recognize it when it wasn't a claim that the plaintiff proceeded on. With regard to 1983, I will just say briefly that this court can't reverse what doesn't exist. There is no order granting summary judgment to MNPS on a Section 1983 claim. Summary judgment was denied across the board with regard to SC, and plaintiff did not appeal the trial judgment. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you vacate the damages award, affirm the summary judgment grant, reverse the Title IX afterclaim judgment, and there's no action needed on Section 1983. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your argument. The case will be submitted.